short uplift than the amount of polonium that was found. She also pioneered radiotherapy. Radioactivity standard was developed by her, and of course she provided these sources which she had made to many researchers, including Rutherford, Lise Meitner and so on, as strong sources of alphas, because they were the only tools that people had at that time for making reactions, for studying them and so on. A little bit about her human side. She came from Poland to Paris to study, because it was not possible in Poland to study for girls, to go into science. So she came to Paris, and actually she did that after supporting her sister. And so she worked for over 4 years, supported her sister, and then in turn her sister supported her a bit. Of course, she got a scholarship which she returned to help other students who had come. She gave much of her Nobel Prize money to various people, friends, family, research associations, and so on. Another remarkable thing was that she, in spite of winning the Nobel Prize in 1903, was denied membership of the French Academy of Sciences. It was a highly male-dominated place. And Pierre Curie, of course, became a member of the Academy, but she never became a member through her life. And this continued even when she got the second Nobel Prize. In fact, she had a lot of problem in getting funding, and she is supposed to have approached Louis Pasteur for funding a radium institute. He said he would do that, and then at that stage, of course, the French government stepped in and then supported her. She did not patent the radium isolation process, saying that this would hinder use by institutions and by researchers. All the monetary gifts award that she got were to be given to scientific institutions, not her. She also deployed these mobile X-ray units and worked in the front line, or just behind the front line in World War I, to assist surgeons in saving the lives, in fact, of many soldiers, injured soldiers. Of course, she founded the Radium Institute, and this is a quote from Einstein, probably the only person who could not be corrupted by fame. Next, we come to the nucleus, and that's another giant here, Ernest Rutherford. Interestingly, Rutherford used to say that chemistry is just a collecting stamps. And ironically, he got the Nobel Prize for chemistry. Of course, he took it rather sportingly. In fact, after he won the Nobel Prize, he visited the Hahn's laboratory, because Hahn was already a very well-known chemist at that time. And there were some exchanges in which Hahn felt a little down when Rutherford, you know, was a very boisterous gentleman. Anyway, he was nominated in chemistry four times. Three people nominated him in 7 and one in 1908 when he got the Nobel Prize. But 20 times for physics, and didn't get a Nobel Prize in physics. Some of his most important work in physics is apart from, of course, studying the disintegration of elements, of categorizing radiation in terms of alpha, beta, and so on, activities, was the radioactive decay law, which he found in 1911. He discovered the nucleus within the atom again in 1911. And interestingly, this I didn't know before, he even proposed that the neutron in the nucleus could perhaps compensate for the repulsion, strong repulsion of protons in the nucleus. The other alternative, he also stated, was that there were some different kinds of electrons, nuclear electrons, which would help bind the nucleus. Of course, he initially did some experiments with Chadwick, but apparently got disinterested when those experiments were not leading anywhere, as, according to him. On the other hand, Chadwick continued and went on to discover the neutron. So this is just an illustration of the experiment by Geiger and Marsden. In those days, the professor used to tell the assistants to do the experiment, and they would carry it out, come back to him with results, and then Rutherford, of course, interpreted the results in terms of a compact nucleus in an atom. And so this is the way the scattering cross-section would go if it were a large object. On the other hand, if there is a compact nucleus, positive charge, then you have excess of large angle scattering. And indeed, this principle was used many times later. Indeed, the whole technique of scattering to find out the structure of any object that you want to study is a very generic method. Okay. So, let me just say something which is of some interest to me. So, there is some, namely the radioactive decay law. Of course, he found this with Soddy, who of course later went on to win a Nobel Prize in chemistry. They were investigating this radium-224, it is called thorium-X in those days. That the law of decay of the activity in all cases appears as an expression of a simple law of chemical change in which one substance only alters at a rate proportional to the amount remaining. And so, this is the decay curve and this is the growth of that activity, the secondary activity. This is from their philosophical magazine paper. And of course, we know how this is applied. In fact, Rutherford applied this radioactive decay law to date the Earth. So, that came out to be of the order of a few billion years. In contrast to the then age of the Earth, which was believed to be only a few hundred million years. So, for instance, carbon-14 is, we use this principle to date archaeological items to about 50 kilo years. There is an interesting thing here that in 1968, Kalfin has a theorem which says the decay rate of any object that's supposed to decay like this, actually the decay rate is 0 at t equal to 0. And in fact, Fleming in 83 proposed that this could be one of the reasons why we don't observe protons to decay, because who knows what is the time scale at which this rate goes from 0 to the asymptotic value which is given here. In the late 80s and mid 90s, Norman proved that this decay law is valid using nuclei, using freshly produced decaying nuclei and old nuclei, and for the case of short lifetimes, and showed that this exponential decay law is valid over a very large range, of course not large enough to make it useful for knowing whether protons should decay or not, but in any case, from t by tau to the 10 to the minus 10 using potassium 40, because this is a long half-life and can be freshly produced, and up to about 45 times the half-life. This is limited by the number of atoms that you can see. The other interesting thing is that if this decay rate is 0 at t equal to 0, this comes out from pretty general principles of quantum mechanics, there is this so-called quantum Zeno effect. That is, you observe a decaying system and keep on observing it at shorter and shorter intervals, you will find that this system doesn't decay. And this was in fact shown in an atomic system by Itano in 1990. Okay. Coming back to the Rutherford experiment, which showed that the atom is composed of a compact nucleus about 10 to the 5 times smaller, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 times smaller than the atom. This scattering was used by Hofstadter, this gentleman here, for which he got a Nobel Prize in 61 for his studies of electron scattering. So, he studied a series of nuclei and used few hundred MeVs of electrons to scatter off nuclei, and showed that the one of the things that we have learnt from these studies is that we get the charge distribution of nuclei, but the stable nuclei that he studied have a radius which goes like a to the 1/3. So, r, this we have all studied in probably BSCs now, r is the radius of a nucleus is equal to r0 times a to the 1/3. So, this came about from studies of this sort. Of course, incidentally, that Nobel Prize was shared with Rudolf Mosbauer, who is probably one of the youngest Nobel Prize winners for his discovery of effect which bears his name. The scattering idea was also, or principle was also used by these three gentlemen who got a Nobel Prize in 1990, Friedman, Kendall and Taylor, by scattering electrons on protons and neutrons which are bound in a nucleus, in a, for instance a deuteron. And now, of course, if you look at the so-called deep inelastic scattering from the constituents of the nucleon, proton or neutron, then you again get large angle scattering which is again due to these point particles. So initially Feynman interpreted them as electron parton scattering, but later these were identified with quarks, which was proposed by Murray Gell-Mann and fetched him a Nobel Prize in 69. Okay, now we come to the discovery of the neutron. This is a single gentleman who got Nobel Prize in 35. As I said already, Rutherford had proposed the existence of the neutron. So this was discovered in 1932. This is the key paper. So about 12 years before this, but he, as I said, he didn't pursue this. He got disinterested after a while. There are other interesting things happening in Cavendish. Bothe and Becker and Irene Curie and the Joliots, they found in the early 30s that a penetrating radiation, which they thought were very high energy gamma rays, in these interactions, alpha plus beryllium 9, they found that the proton recoils when paraffin is interposed. So it is surprising that they didn't interpret this as neutrons. However, they didn't do that. And Chadwick immediately caught on to this. And he, of course, used strong sources of alphas to produce neutrons. And then neutrons were made to interact with substances in a cloud chamber. And this was a very definitive thing. This neutrons comes in from here and the proton recoils. The proton is, of course, in a cloud chamber. It has a fairly long range. And therefore, he could identify. And then, of course, he did various targets, angular distributions, and so on. And at the end of the day, the conclusion was that he had discovered the neutron. And therefore, now, from then on, the nucleus was supposed to consist of n neutrons and z protons to make its mass number A. Okay. The next step was probably the artificial radioactivity, which was discovered by the Joliots, Frederick Joliot and Irene Curie, the daughter of Marie Curie, for their synthesis of new radioactive elements. And shortly thereafter, so they used charged particles to produce these new radioactivities. On the other hand, Enrico Fermi used the newly discovered neutron to produce elements. And he thought he was not only light nuclei, but he was also looking at heavy nuclei. And he was trying to produce transuranic nuclei. And these were discovered by him in the course of his studies, where he interposed paraffin just on the spur of the moment when he was actually going to put lead. But when he put paraffin, he found that the reaction rate increased tremendously. And this is part of history now. So he could produce radioactivity much faster this way by slowing down the neutrons. Okay, Fermi, of course, has several other contributions. I'll come back to one other contribution of Joliot, Frederick Joliot. That's probably the next few slides. But let me state something about Fermi. Now, Fermi is probably the only, I don't know of any other, but probably the only physicist who has made seminal contributions in theoretical physics and experimental physics. So, just a few examples of that. We all know Fermi-Dirac statistics, which is applicable to half-integral spin particles. Quantum transition, you have the Fermi's golden rules. He was the first one to write down the quantum field theory of beta decay after Dirac wrote it down for the electromagnetic interaction. And of course, you have also probably heard of the paper which he wrote and got rejected by Nature as being too speculative. And interesting. So, some time ago, if you remember, one of the editors of Nature had come here and he said, this is probably one of the biggest mistakes that we made, rejecting Fermi's paper. He has also worked on the origin of cosmic rays. Experimental science, of course, this is the work for which he got the Nobel Prize, but he also was involved in showing that the fission chain reaction can be controlled, and this led to the graphite moderated reactor that he built in Chicago, one of the, I think, basketball fields or something like that. He was one of the key persons in the Manhattan Project, which is to make the atomic bomb. And later, when he went back to Chicago, he entered this rather tough field I mean, of nucleon resonances and pion physics, but he took it up. He said, okay, these are the things, this area is difficult, but you have to get on with it. This is the only way of making progress, finding resonances, looking at their properties, spin parities, and so on. Okay. Otto Hahn, while studying at, I'll come to the story of this. Lise Meitner and Otto Hahn were at Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, and she was the physics person, and she was collaborating with Hahn, who was an excellent chemist, who actually had been nominated for Nobel Prize for his chemistry work many times before. So they were looking at a program of looking for transuranic elements. There was competition, of course. The Jolyos were doing it in Paris, Fermi was doing it in at Rome, and so on. But this kind of research led to the discovery of fission. And Meitner had a key role to play in that, although she missed out on this Nobel Prize because she had to leave Germany about 6 months before this discovery. Life was becoming very difficult for Jews there, and there was the possibility that she might be sent to a concentration camp and so on. So Hahn helped her in go away to Sweden, initially to Holland and then to Sweden. Apparently she had only 10 marks with her when she had to leave without anything at all. And on the other, of course, Hahn did give her a diamond ring, which he said you might use to bribe the German authorities at the border of Holland and Germany in case it is needed. She didn't have to use it. There is a scientist from Holland who came to the border and who interacted with the authorities, the German authorities, and she was allowed to leave. Okay, so the sequence of events was rather rapid. This Hahn and Strassmann wrote this paper, and this was discovered in December around Christmas, but they were not really confident about interpreting these results because the heavy nucleus of uranium, when bombarded by thermal neutrons, seemed to have broken up into two objects. I mean, they didn't know that this was broken up, but when they made this reaction, they found krypton and barium. And Hahn, being an excellent chemist, he was absolutely sure that this was barium. Okay, it was not something like radium or something. Okay. So he wrote to Meitner to help in interpreting these results. Meitner very quickly, at that time Frisch was, her nephew was visiting her in Sweden, where apparently she just had a table and chair. Sigband didn't give her anything else, no lab, nothing. And she was already she was an eminent professor at that time, 38, so she was about 60 years old at that time, roughly. Okay, so the only way she kept herself academically active was by interacting with people like Bohr and so on, in Niels Bohr Institute and things like that. So, and Frisch, who visited her sometimes. So they discovered that the only solution to this must be that uranium fissions. And they knew about the liquid drop model of Bohr, and they worked it out. The energy release is of the order of 200 MeV. So this was in Christmas of 38, just a short while after this, letter from Hahn and Strassmann, and the Nature article was submitted very soon, but it appeared roughly at the same time that I think the Hahn paper appeared. I don't have the dates here. Okay, Frisch also went back, Cavendish probably, and measured these fission fragments in a detector. So there was absolutely clear evidence that there were two fragments coming out and that this was fission. Subsequently, of course, Niels Bohr and John Wheeler worked out. There is a quote here of Niels Bohr when Frisch and Meitner found a solution to this observation. Oh, what idiots we have been. This is just as it must be. And this is a quote from C.P. Snow's The Physicist. So these are the people involved: Hahn, Meitner, Bohr, and Frisch. Something about Lise Meitner on the discovery. Lise Meitner, as I said, she initiated the work on investigating the so-called transuranium program with Otto Hahn. And they had an excellent collaboration. She had to leave. in mid 38. Interestingly, she was nominated for Nobel Prize 48 times, 19 times in the period between 24 and 48. This is the first person who nominated her, and this is the last, Bohr. Physics, she was nominated 20 times, the first nomination coming from Heisenberg, last one coming from Born, Max Born, and surprisingly, she didn't get it. Really tragic. It appears that Lise Meitner, this is by three authors who have an article in Physics Today, science historians. It appears that Lise Meitner did not share the 44 Nobel Prize because the structure of the Nobel committees was ill-suited to assess interdisciplinary work. She was a physicist, she was a chemist, and they were working together. Meitner's exclusion from the chemistry award may well be summarized as a mixture of disciplinary bias, political obtuseness, ignorance, and haste. Of course, much stronger words were used in private. And Lise Meitner also felt bad about this. In fact, although they were quite, civil when they met, but she was quite unhappy with Otto Hahn, not just for this, because he would take credit in public gatherings for this discovery, that he did it all alone. But apart from that, she also was unhappy with him because he supported the war effort in Germany. And she was one of those few who, although she found the explanation for the fission, she did not take part in the bomb program at all. She resisted, she just didn't have anything to do with that throughout her career. Okay, now of course, the fission reaction is important in many ways. One destructive, as happened in the case of the bomb. Maybe this is somewhat constructive, but it also led to a huge amount of science funding because of the Manhattan Project and the fallout from there. So just to go through a quick history, the Joliots, von Halban and Kowalski, they demonstrated neutron multiplication. They immediately filed for three patents, two for power production, one for the bomb. Leo Szilard, he proposed the chain reaction in 33. Quite some time before the fission reaction was discovered, but this was to do with charged particle reactions. Filed a patent and tried, in fact, to create a chain reaction with beryllium and indium. Landau, incidentally, also had something to say at that time. He said that if the neutron can cause a reaction which produces more than one neutron, then perhaps you can get a chain reaction. It was quite prophetic, way before fission was discovered. Of course, then this is all history. Szilard persuaded Einstein to write a letter to Roosevelt, which ultimately led to the Manhattan Project after this was demonstrated that you can have a chain reaction, a controlled chain reaction. These are some pictures from the net. Okay, now alpha sources as tools of studying nuclei, making reactions, making new elements and so on, or indeed probing nuclei, has its limitations. So, if you want to have a wider scope, you need energetic particles to be produced artificially, not only the ones which you get from alphas, from the radioactive sources. And so, these were to become the tools of discovery. John Cockcroft and Ernest Walton, they were the first to get off to try to make an accelerator. That led to the voltage multiplier, which we had the similar kind of machine here called the cascade generator. They started probably even a little before Ernest Lawrence with full support from Rutherford. Interestingly, at that time, Gamow happened to be visiting Cavendish, and Gamow's theory of alpha decay was already well known. That is one of the first applications of quantum mechanics to study tunnel, or to say that, okay, alpha is tunnel through a barrier. Now, Rutherford was quick to appreciate that if you can have alpha coming out, you can also have the alpha coming in the other way. And therefore, you don't need really to climb up to energies above the Coulomb barrier. Even if you are well below the Coulomb barrier, you still have a small probability that the thing can tunnel. So, if you have enough number of particles, you can make nuclear reactions. This is quite nice, and therefore, he strongly supported Cockcroft and Walton in building machines, which in those days were not very high voltage, 300 kilovolt to 500 kilovolt. On the other side of the Atlantic, Ernest Lawrence got this idea of the cyclotron resonance, that if you have a particle moving in a magnetic field, the cyclotron frequency is independent of the energy. And so, if you accelerate a particle using RF by, let us say, 2 d's or a single d, then it will come back in the right phase, because the time does not depend on the frequency, or does not depend on the energy. Okay? So, you can keep on accelerating this particle, and this led to a Nobel Prize as well for him. He got it somewhat earlier than Cockcroft or Walton in 1939 for the invention of the cyclotron and making artificial radioactive elements, which the similar was the purpose of this machine as well. Interestingly, at around the same time that these people were working on such acceleration of particles in the late 20s and 30s, early 30s, Widerøe also built a linear accelerator, the first RF linear accelerator. Van de Graaff built a high voltage DC device in 1929. So, you can see that, you know, somehow these ideas of making accelerators was around, and people used different techniques of making these accelerated particles. So, Cockcroft-Walton, for instance, saw this reaction, lithium 7 plus 3 going to 2 alphas, this I have already said, following Gamow's theory of alpha decay run backwards. And Lawrence also was using deuterons to make activities and study them. By the way, this he used deuterons, which were very recently discovered. The heavy water was discovered by Urey just a few years ago, and he immediately used these to study reactions. Of course, this led to this is spawned out into many kinds of accelerators of increasing power and so on, and this became absolutely the essential tool for nuclear physics initially, then high energy physics, but also for other applications in condensed matter, atomic physics and things like that. So, this is a picture of the early Cockcroft-Walton. This is probably Walton sitting inside this Faraday cage, so not to be zapped by one of these sparks that could happen. And this is a more modern version of the Cockcroft-Walton, about 1,000,000 volts. This is about 500 kilovolts. This is a picture of the first cyclotron built by Lawrence, literally string and wax. You can see the wax here, which seals off things, seals it from the air. So, the vacuum inside this on the palm of a hand. And this is the biggest one which he built. This magnet was actually used in the so-called calutron devices, one of the biggest calutron. And this was used also later to make the 184-inch cyclotron, one of the biggest cyclotrons of his time. Okay, now we come to nuclear. How am I doing in time? Let us see. Okay. Come to the both the interaction that is responsible to hold, at least at that time, what was believed to be so, which is still valid in the low energy domain. So, this is the seminal contribution of Yukawa, so nuclear force, structure and symmetries. Yukawa applied quantum mechanics to look at what causes the nuclear force, and he came up with this idea that if you exchange a light particle, in this case it turned out to be the pi meson. Initially it was believed that this was the mu meson, but this was corrected later on. So, if you have a heavy particle shed, then obviously there is a range to that interaction, and he worked out that the mass of this exchange particle for the particle which is extended to cause the nuclear interaction is of the order of 100 MeV, which is borne out to this accuracy reasonably later. Powell, of course, discovered this particle. He used emulsions, very nice emulsions by Ilford. Apparently, there is a history to it, in that an Indian group working in Darjeeling also did this experiment, but the quality of the emulsion was not as good to definitively say that they had seen the pan. Powell had, of course, being in England, and Ilford was the British company, he could have emulsions of much better quality and therefore could study the pan and its decay. That led to his Nobel Prize in 1950. As for the structure of the nucleus, the earliest model of the nucleus was that of a liquid drop, which was the Bohr paradigm. And that indeed has its great success in the explaining fission. So that's a kind of collective model. However, there were observations made by Meyer and Jensen, which showed that there are small things, deviations from this picture. For instance, the binding energies show structure which peaks. The binding energies change to give you structures near so-called shell closures, which they identified. There are other properties like magnetic moments, spin parities, and so on, which could be explained if you assume that above, beyond a mean field, which a single nucleon sees in a nucleus, there is also a so-called spin orbit interaction. And the spin orbit interaction was the key to explain these shell closures. And of course, Wigner got his Nobel Prize for generally his contributions to the use of symmetry in unifying various properties of the nucleus as well as the atom and elementary particles. So he got one half of this prize in 1963, and Maria Goppert Mayer and Jensen shared the other half. Wigner, as I said, demonstrated the importance of these symmetries. I should have added atomic physics, because that's how he started, using group theory to classify states in atoms and molecules. And then the same thing carried over for nuclei as well as particles. So for instance, you have spin, isospin parity, which classify nuclear states. Of course, he also contributed to many other areas. And one of the areas concerning nuclear physics is the theory of nuclear resonances. So Bright-Wigner, you might have heard of this Bright-Wigner formula, and also the statistical properties of nuclei and excited states. So nearest neighbor distances and so on. Okay, so this is the shell model for which these people got the Nobel Prize. So the key to the levels which are which can be calculated in a mean field is the introduction of the large spin orbit interaction, which leads to these gaps in at certain intervals. And so if you have a nucleus with filled states up to here, this is somewhat more stable than the average nucleus somewhere else, somewhere let's say mid shell. And this went against the conventional wisdom of that time. There's in fact there are two review articles written by Bethe, which were called the Bethe Bible, and so this went against that. But in any case, they showed that there is enough evidence for this, and that was borne out. Now, this was the so-called spherical shell model. Rainwater and then later Bohr and Mortensen worked out many, many details to unify this picture of a single particle motion in not just spherical mean fields, but in deformed mean fields. Later, both the Nordita as well as Niels Bohr Institute group contributed to also extending this to rotating nuclei. Okay. So single particle motion in both deformed mean field as well as in rotating mean fields. Okay, so this is the citation. Bohr, Mortensen and Rainwater in 75 for the discovery of the connection between collective motion and particle motion in atomic nuclei, deformed nuclei, and the development of the theory of the structure of atomic nucleus based on this connection. Incidentally, their volume 2 of this, the Bohr-Mortensen Bible, was also published in the same year, 1975. Volume 1 was 69. That continues to actually be an excellent textbook, although somewhat advanced. So these are the key articles. Okay, now I mentioned that Wigner got his Nobel Prize for his contribution to looking at symmetries in various systems, including nuclei. The nucleus has been extremely useful in testing many of these symmetries. The most well-known is, of course, the symmetry of parity. So parity is a symmetry where, I'll come to the next slide, where it's symmetric under space reflection. So the vector r goes to minus r and the system remains the same, then this is parity is conserved. On the other hand, if under this operation it behaves differently, then of course parity is violated. And it was believed, because strong interactions or nuclei have good spin parities and so on, so it was believed that parity is a good symmetry. However, when the question was asked, and I don't know really, they haven't dug too deep, but in 56 in one of the particle physics meetings, apparently this question was asked by somebody who was sharing the room with Feynman, that how do you know is parity conserved in weak interactions? And he was, of course, somebody who said that parity is a good quantum number and it should be good. But then at that point he said, okay, I don't think there is evidence that it is, so he, that this is conserved. And indeed he said it at the, in the summary session of that particle physics, it was a Rochester meeting, I think. And the Wu and, Yang and Li were also there in the same meeting, sorry. And of course, they took it up immediately, they worked on it, and they in fact asked Wu, is parity conserved in weak interactions in beta decay? And she gave them a volume, it seems, of this Sigban, about 1,000 pages or something. I said, maybe you should look at this and then decide. They went through it and they didn't find any evidence for parity being conserved, and that's how they immediately wrote this paper. Then Wu got interested and she did the experiment. So this was probably one of the fastest Nobel Prizes, because they wrote this paper in 56 and got the Nobel Prize in 57, Yang and Li. Yeah, that's right. So you should look. You should precisely. Precisely. Yes, it's a very short paper. In fact, many of the fundamental papers are very short. The Crick and Watson paper is also extremely short. So anyway, this led to Wu putting together a collaboration, as one might call it. These days, it's not such a big collaboration, but she got the National Institute of Standards people who are very well experienced in cryogenics. So these are the people, Hayward and his group. She got them interested and they set this experiment up. Basically, they were looking for a P odd observable. So under parity, if the observable changes sign, then if parity is conserved, this observable should be identically zero. Okay. And so you look at a variable like sigma of the nucleus dotted with the momentum of the electron, the beta decay electron. Okay. Now you can see that under r going to minus r, this changes sign, this doesn't, so this is odd under p, and if parity is conserved, this should be zero. So the statement of the problem is rather simple, that you should look for a asymmetry in beta decay from polarized cobalt 60, but this was really a very difficult experiment. They had to go down to 3 millikelvin, so that's where the cryogenic expertise of the NIST group came in. And she was the one, of course, who planned the experiment and so on. And so if you polarize cobalt, you get betas coming mainly from, so to speak, the south pole, and this is what she observed. So this leads to a asymmetry in the counting rate, and with the field down, it is one way, with the field up, it is another way. So it is opposite, right, to the field. Now, of course, the as the thing warms up, then you get this asymmetry to vanish. So this shows that your asymmetry measurement is okay. This one? Yeah, so this I think took about a few, 6 months or something like that. I'm not sure, maybe it was 4 months. But it is of the order of a, certainly of a few months, 3 to 6 months is what I... No, so this paper, as you said, was published here, okay, in 57. So, I mean, as I said, maybe it is 6 months. I haven't looked up the date on this. But interestingly, she, I mean, the other people in the department were also talking to Wu and seeing this experiment going on. And Lederman did this experiment using muons, and he found that there is a decay asymmetry in the muons. And that experiment was apparently done almost over a weekend, because it so happens that the muons are created polarized, and you just have to look at their decay. Not only that, the offshoot of that was that this muon also precesses in the magnetic field, so you can find out the magnetic moment of the muon. And indeed, this is an application that you can immediately foresee, that you can put it into condensed matter systems and look at the internal magnetic field. So that experiment, because they had access to a synchrotron in the basement apparently. And so he and his younger colleagues, they just did this experiment over the weekend. And that paper and another one of Telegdy were used in emulsion to find out this asymmetry in muon decay. That these papers were, I mean, the Letterman paper I think was published just next to Wu's paper. I haven't looked up the Telegdy paper, but it's probably published at a similar time. So that could have been the problem why Wu missed out on the Nobel Prize, because if it had been only Wu, probably, okay, there was also this question of the other authors here, multiple authors, but since she had conceived of this experiment and, you know, carried it out, it's quite likely that she would have got the Nobel Prize. But the fly in the ointment was probably the fact that Lederman and Telegdy had published similar results at around that same time. So, but of course, she was a great experimentalist. Pardon? Yes. No, no. I mean, yeah, yeah. Lederman is quite well known. Yeah. Because of, you know, otherwise it would have made too many slides. Otherwise, I could have added a slide of Lederman as well. But I'm just saying it. Yeah. So, this was just around that time. Okay. Then there is another time reversal invariance. In fact, this was looked at actually to find out if parity is violated. Is there a electric dipole moment to the neutron? Okay. So this was something that Purcell and Ramsey looked at as early as 1950. However, they carried out a preliminary experiment, but didn't publish it. And they published only in 1957, the fact that there is a dipole limit on the electric dipole moment of the neutron. So this is the paper here, experimental limit to the electric dipole moment of the neutron. Now the way it goes is that since d is rho of r integrated over the volume of the nucleus times r, so this is odd under parity, and therefore if parity is conserved, the electric dipole moment should be zero. But what about time reversal? Okay, the only quantity or the vector that can be associated with a neutron is the spin. Okay, and the spin being a pseudo vector, I shouldn't say pseudo vector. Spin being something that transforms in the same way as r cross p, it is odd under time reversal invariance. So again, if you find a finite dipole moment of the neutron, this also means that time reversal invariance is violated. Okay. So, neutrons have been traditionally used to measure or to put to search for an electric dipole moment, and which would signal if it is found to be finite, the time reversal invariance is violated in the neutron. And this is the way the limit has progressed. So, in the very initial years, this limit was something like 10 to the minus 19 ECM in these units. This was around something like 55 in their early experiments, and then this has moved by something like six and a half orders of magnitude at roughly the present time. At the present time, actually, there are almost 6 to 7 experiments going on at various labs to try to push this by another actually 2 orders of magnitude. Some are trying to push it to by 1 order of magnitude, and some others are trying to push it as far as 2 orders of magnitude. Of course, the standard model prediction is something like 10 to the minus 32, so that's a long way. But if you discover a finite dipole moment, electric dipole moment, this would immediately signal physics beyond the standard model. That's the interest. Okay, I think I should not spend too much time on the principle, but I'll be happy to answer if anybody has a question on the technique that is used. Okay, coming to the nuclear synthesis. So, Bethe was the first one in the mid-30s to suggest that the energy that is coming out from the sun cannot be due to the infall of matter, so gravitational energy, potential energy being converted to light and so on. So he suggested that nuclear reactions are taking place. In the first paper, he suggested the so-called carbon-nitrogen-oxygen cycle, but then he went to the PP cycle. Interestingly, in the PP cycle, the first reaction is P plus P going to D plus E plus. It doesn't have a neutrino there. This was in 37, when already Fermi had proposed the neutrino, but interestingly, the reaction is not right, but he probably was shy of putting the neutrino there because it is an undiscovered particle at that time. Later in 83, Willy Fowler, and this is the last Nobel Prize actually connected with nuclear physics, by the way, he won this, the citation for his Nobel Prize was that for his theoretical and experimental studies of nuclear reactions of importance to the formation of chemical elements. Just for completeness sake, and also because there is a connection to a great astrophysicist, Chandrasekhar, much after his main body of work was done, he got his finally his Nobel Prize for studies related to structure evolution of stars. So, as I said, the infall of matter would, the sun would only last for 30 mega years, million years, given the amount of radiation that is putting out. It's also too short for the evolution of life on Earth, and indeed radioactivity was used to date rocks to about 5 giga years, and the Earth being in possibly an offshoot of the sun cannot be much older than the sun. So, any case, there are arguments to say that nuclear reactions must be powering the core of stars. And so, initially he proposed the CNO and then the PP cycles, and these are some of the relevant papers. So, these are the cycles, the PP1, PP2 and PP3. Again, basically the first reaction is the one which produces deuterium and involves the weak interaction, and that's what makes the sun burn very slowly, and that's what makes it, will make it last for another probably 5 to 10 billion years before it dies and becomes something else. The CNO cycle is relevant in hotter stars, not so much in the sun, but this is what he proposed at that first paper. And then there are three cycles and so on. You can see that everything ends at mass 8, okay? And this is also radioactive. Boron 8 is radioactive, beryllium 8 is very short lived indeed. So you get back to, so basically 4 protons make an alpha and the other positrons and so on to balance the reaction, 2 neutrinos. Okay. So this is the bottleneck. How do you go beyond this? If you want to go to the CNO cycle, you need to cross this bottleneck. This is where Hoyle comes in. He's the last author in this so-called BB, what is that, FH paper, which set down the, you know, the basically the paradigm for nucleosynthesis. So these are the reactions. As I said, this is a repeat, but the real signal of that these indeed are taking place in the core of the sun is if you can measure these neutrinos, and they have been measured, of course. So I'll not get into that. But how do you cross the A equal to 8 bottleneck? So this is something that was solved by this gentleman, Fred Hoyle. So he suggested that, by the way, this crossing of beryllium the A equal to 8 bottleneck, people have attacked it, Bethe, Saltpeter, and they all came up saying that no, this is not good enough, you can't make carbon 12. So he came up with this idea that if in stars you can make an alpha beryllium 8 reaction and this goes to a specific state, so it's a resonant reaction, then this reaction can go through and then you can make carbon, and then of course once you get to carbon you can make heavier elements. And so basically he said that this state should be there in carbon, and indeed this was found by a group in the US. So this is the reference where he proposed, and this is the Dunbar reference in 1953 where they found this state at about this right energy, 7.6. Now, in the 83 Nobel Prize, the story goes that when Fowler got his phone call in the early morning from Stockholm, he answered that phone call, he then called up Fred Hoyle and said that you must have got it too. You must have got a phone call from Stockholm too. He said, no, I didn't get a phone call. So this was a big omission on the part of the Nobel Committee, and very significant omission. It is believed that he was somewhat of a anti-establishment guy. He had made some statements about why so-and-so didn't get a Nobel Prize, should have shared it and so on. So maybe that was one of the reasons why, or maybe something else. But certainly many, many people feel that this seminal contribution, because otherwise you get stuck at A equal to 7. You can't go beyond that. And to make anything like the elements that we see, you have to have a state here, and this is what he had predicted precisely. So this was another mystery why the Nobel committee didn't do this. Okay, then how can heavier elements be made? Okay, so if you want to make elements, you can go on making these reactions in hotter and hotter places in the universe, which means in stars of which have hotter and hotter cores, and you can do that up to iron. Charged particle reactions can be used to make nuclei up to iron. How do you go beyond that? For that, you have to have neutron captures, and they can take place surely in supernova, where neutrons can get captured. Then if it gets captured before a beta decay, then it goes on, and finally when beta decay takes over, then you can make this whole range of neutron rich nuclei. However, it turns out that that is not enough to explain the abundances of the elements, and the recently discovered neutron-neutron star mergers in the gravitational wave discovery are believed to be places where these very heavy elements can be made in the numbers that we see. So I come to the last part, which is that so-called radioactive ion beam facilities will access many of these nuclei, which are involved in explosive processes. I'm going to say this is the region of stable nuclei. There are about 300 in number. About 3,000 nuclei are known, although very little is known about them. There's spin parity, how they decay, what are cool moments, memory moments, and so on. But about 7,000 to 8,000 are believed to exist, which are particle stable, and probably many more which are resonant states. So there's a huge area here in this Z-N plane which needs to be addressed, and this is one of the ways of doing that, to build so-called radioactive ion beam facilities where you can access both neutron rich and neutron rich. So this is just a slide to say that if you have neutron star merger, are there heavier elements? So, are there so called super heavy elements? So, there is a possibility that there is a region of NZ plane where you have Z numbers of between 116 and 124 or so. The number is not exact, depends on the models. But you might have nuclei here which are stable, and how stable they could even live for a billion years. We all know that hydrogen of atomic number, mass number 1, 2 and 3 due to repetition, but of course resonant state of H7 is also. So there are, you go heavier and heavier, the whole range of nuclei which are known. Heaviest one, there are 3 aspects. So in any case, now the early work was done by Macmillan and Seaborg. Incidentally, Macmillan is the one who discovered phase stability. Quest for super heavy elements, of course, uses various approaches which are pioneered by this gentleman, Russian Kutinsky. This is use a liquid drop plus a shell correction, and then you can compute these binding energies to about a few MeV precision, which then predicts a lovely magic number of this order, but depending on the model, this can change. So it is expected that you can have half lives which could be milliseconds. large number of neutrons, then they fission spontaneously. They will emit a large number. So, okay, this is about the discovery of the heaviest element that is known right now, element 118. Okay, so this is the periodic table in science from IUPAC website. And so, the last one is named after a Russian scientist, I think, who is still alive, Ognesian. And then there are various names, Meitnerium is one of them, also there are 9 Meitnerium. One goes by the name of Nihonium, discovered in Japan. Farabi actually took off after Tanihata, as part of his PhD, discovered a devil act
that lithium-11 shows an anomalously large radius.
Okay. So you see, this follows the a to the 1/3, which we have learnt in school almost, whereas this deviates. So if you actually see the radius of the last two neutrons in lithium-11, they are as they have a special extension as large as lead-208. So the experiment was very simple. You produce these beams in so-called fragmentation reactions. You take a heavy nucleus, then you fragment it, you just basically chop it off, and then do a very simple experiment. You impinge it on a target and see how many come out, and you plot that as a function of thickness of the target, and you get a interaction cross section, which you can relate to the interaction radius, and this is what you found. So this started this field. So this gentleman has been apparently nominated a few times, but has not yet made it to the final list. And given that Lise Meitner had 48 nominations, it's not even clear that he might ever get it. But anyway, he has been nominated. Okay. So what do we hope to learn? What do we hope to learn from these exotic nuclei, such as lithium-11? And indeed, now there are factories which can make these in very large numbers, so you can probably address the super heavy elements using neutron-rich RIBs as well. You can probably discover new experiments. Already this soft dipole mode has been found. There will be new magic numbers. The magic numbers that we know for so-called stable nuclei indeed change as you go to off stability line. The interaction is modified, and this interaction is relevant to neutron stars. We are talking about neutron-rich nuclei. They can also provide sometimes a combination of states such that you can test fundamental symmetries in a much better way. Of course, nuclear astrophysics, there is an immediate application. And the other application is, of course, for, let's say, reactor neutrino experiments. There are some anomalies which sort of smoke have led to smoking gun signals, which perhaps could signify that there are sterile neutrinos which mix with the neutrinos that we know. But in order to help pin this down, we need better experiments to study the decay properties of these neutron-rich nuclei produced in the fission of uranium-235, plutonium, and so on. So this is an immediate application. It also is useful for reactors. This is one of the pressing problems of reactor physics. What is the decay heat? The reactor shuts down for how long, and what is the time dependence of the heat production? Okay, this I'll skip, but I'll just point out that there are several facilities either being built or already built. For instance, the RIBF, the radioactive ion beam factory in Japan, is already working. Is being built in the US. High Isolde is already working. Spiral 2 is getting built. FAIR will get built on a slightly longer time scale. And then there are a couple of facilities being built in China, also in India, South Korea. Okay, I think I will skip this. So the limits of excitation, for instance, you look for both liquid gas phase transition, or you already have evidence for plasma. Which heavy elements are you talking about? The very heaviest elements or the super heavy? Okay, the super heavy is incidentally very little is known. So, for instance, we know that heaviest element only 3 decays have been seen. Okay, So we know them through their alpha decays to nuclei which are already been studied before. So the lower down in A you go or Z you go, then they have maybe there are 15, maybe there are 30 events which are seen, but very little is known about them. So and alphas will be of no use in actually identifying those nuclei. So unless they are studied, and that can only happen with radioactive ion beams, you have to start out with a neutron rich beam, make a reaction and then perhaps go there. Even then there will be difficulties because these nuclei fission. When you come in with a certain beam energy, the excitation is already too high and therefore this thing just breaks apart even before it forms a so called compound nucleus. So it would be difficult, but this is the way to go, unless you find in some lucky case that you have a gamma ray or something emitted, then there may be a chance of seeing that. Okay. So if you find nuclei which are say million years half life, maybe there is a chance of seeing them, because then they might even decay through fission fragments and those gamma rays might. But again, one has to wait. I think this is early days for these heavy element spectroscopy. This 80 years you are referring to what, the Nobel Prize? I mean the nucleus was actually discovered in about 1911, so it's more than 100 years since that was discovered. Yes. There is no specific case. For instance, the neutron dipole, and by the way, I didn't say anything about other nuclei where the limits on nuclear neutron electric dipole moment are even more stringent. But in terms of fundamental particle EDMs, they are not as stringent because of the so-called Schiff effect. But people have been looking at both the neutron electric dipole moment as well as, let's say, in Mercury. Mercury 199 is a classic case. They have looked at it. And those lip bounds are, by the way, about a factor of, I think, 100 better. So in case somebody discovers a electric dipole moment, then it will lead to what you say, physics beyond the standard model. Up to now, no. Up to now, it is basically looking for refinements or to improve our understanding of, let's say, the weak force in nuclei. The other thing, for instance, that people have been looking at is to see whether the Kabibu angle is quenched in heavy systems. There is no evidence of it yet, but the heaviest systems that they have looked at is, I think, something like the best cases to look at are Z equal to N nuclei, and I think rubidium, one of these nuclei, N equal to Z has been looked at. Of course, they have not found yet quenching. But these are some of the areas which people are looking for something new. It hasn't happened yet. That's the short answer. Okay. We have an even better example. The gravitational wave was discovered after initial experiments in what, 50s or something, 50s, 60s. Okay, so it took them so many, it took so much time. Well, this is a difficult problem. So super heavy elements, some people say that we have already found super heavy elements, element 118 being one of them. But we have not really reached the center of that island. Okay, so this may be on the periphery. Because it is true that the lifetimes of these nuclei should have been much shorter. They are much longer already, although they might be a few milliseconds, but they should have decayed in microseconds. If you remember, if you don't remember, I'll tell you. In polonium-212, there is a state which decays in about, 100 or so microseconds. Okay, so 100 nanoseconds. So this is already very long on that time scale. So it is very likely that we are approaching that super heavy element island, but in order to make further progress, there have to be newer experimental techniques which have to be used, such as, for instance, one of the ways is radioactive ion beams. So there are two ways of doing that apparently. One way is that you take a radioactive ion beam and make it collide with another, possibly even radioactive or stable ion beam, neutron rich beam, in a collinear fashion. So you have an accelerator where you have GeV particles, GeV per nucleon, but the relative energy is only 5 MeV per nucleon, because if you go much higher, you don't make these nuclei. You have to go through the fusion compound nuclear process. But the relative energy is small. What is the advantage of doing that? Even if you form just one nucleus, you can identify it, because at that high energy, you can use detector schemes to get the Z and A very precisely. You can use time of flight, you can use the deviation and the magnetic field, and so even if you have one nucleus, you can identify it. And then having implanted that in a detector, you can keep looking at it, how fast does it decay. If it doesn't decay in, let's say, a year, then you know that it's probably a much longer than a year, so it may be one of those super heavy elements in that island. There is another way, but okay, maybe we can discuss it.
This institute,
yes.
In order to make nuclear physics in some sense, it was established for.
Yes.
That's because of our involvement, especially meson physics.
Yes.
Speculations about pion and muon.
Yeah.
He was very involved. Made some initial speculations, papers on sorts of or minerals.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, one other thing that I might add is that his was probably the one of the first applications, or let's say demonstrations, that special relativity works, with the fact that the muon flux is there at ground level. It shouldn't have been there had it been produced in the upper atmosphere if relativity was not there. That's one of the things. That's right. That's right. Cockcroft, yeah, he set that up to basically study nuclear reactions at that time. I think in the mid-50s or something. But other than that, I don't know whether he made any contributions in nuclear physics. I don't think so. But he had people, you know, whom he had joined. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there is a picture, of course, that it may be just that at that time it was installed, where he's standing by the side of the cascade generator. But I don't think he was involved in any of the experiments. Okay. I have heard stories that people used to climb onto the gates, you know, get the key from somewhere and then surreptitiously enter the lab and get out. Because Rutherford's idea behind this diktat was that don't just keep on doing experiments. You should also have time to think. Think. That was the key word. You go even earlier to think. Yeah, yeah.
I remember. People
used to
work in the night.
Yes.
I mean,
Van de Graaff and so on.
But now,
Yeah, now.
So let's thank
Yeah.